You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the equine network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
Well, good morning, everybody. I am Glenn the Geek from Ocala, Florida, and you're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for Monday, September 29th, episode 3785 by Worm Flooring. Good morning, horse world. Well, Jamie has not made it back from Hershey. Apparently, they could not get flights yesterday, so they're flying back this morning. I do know that they had a great time there. They had a great time at the concert. They had a great time eating chocolate and going to the park, and I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about that on Wednesday. So today, it's just me, but I have a couple of guests. Cheryl Erickson, author of Greyhound, the remarkable story of the legendary racehorse who inspired a nation, tells us about this amazing standardbred trotting horse who became quite the sensation. Coach Jen's going to stop by and give us an update on her first gated horse, James, and I have a story to end the show. In the Auditor Post Show, I'm going to share my thoughts on the end of 17 years as a boss. We'll talk about that a little bit for the auditors in the post show. The auditor birthdays for today are Alexandra Sandiford, Casey Berger, Christy Collins, and we have two friends of the show that have birthdays also, Templeton Thompson, the singer-songwriter, of course, and comedian Pam Stone, who you've heard here on the show as well. Happy birthday to all of you. We hope you have a terrific day. We also have two brand new auditors, Gary Rupp and J.D. Crawley. We thank you guys for joining up and becoming part of the family. And if you haven't yet, search for HRN Auditors on Facebook, and you'll find us hanging out over there. I did want to mention to all the auditors that I'm going to be posting probably tomorrow morning, Tuesday morning, about the focus group. It's time to switch the focus group out. We have a group of volunteers that volunteer for 6 months, and they basically have their own Facebook page, and they comment on every episode and talk about our guests and our content. They really do help Jamie and I out. They help us understand what's working and what's not working for you guys, and we've had a terrific group the last 6 months, and we thank them for their service, but we'll be looking for a new group. It's a lot of work having to comment on daily show, and we understand that, so we only ask people to do it for a six-month period of time. And we'll be looking for our next batch of volunteers. I saw three or four of you already chimed in, and we're looking for about a dozen people who are willing to just join the Facebook group and comment on the episodes they listen to and give us their honest feedback, and that helps us dictate the focus and the path going forward of the show. So we really do appreciate you guys doing that. Wormflooring.com now does your trailer roof. Leaky roofs are a very common problem in horse trailers and RVs. I know our RV had a leak I had to fix. Worm Flooring's revolutionary silicone-based coating creates a barrier against heat and wet. It seals your roof to stop leaks before they start. And it reflects back nearly 90% of those nasty UV rays, keeping your trailer or barn up to 60 degrees cooler on a blistering day. So dish the duct tape and the buckets, invest in a long-term peace of mind with Seal and Chill. It's applied by pros for a flawless finish, and it's only $7.50 per square foot. That's a steal for a cooler, drier, happier trailer or RV, which means happier horses and happier people. Head on over to Worm Flooring, that's WERMflooring.com, to find a dealer near you. Well, let's get to our first guest. We have author Cheryl Erickson coming on to talk about her book, Greyhound, the remarkable story of the legendary racehorse who inspired a nation. Well, Cheryl, thanks so much for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Glenn. It's great to be here.
So you have this book. It's called Greyhound, the remarkable story of the legendary racehorse who inspired a nation. But before we get to that, you've written a couple other books with horses involved, but not racehorses, right?
That is true. Yes. Yeah. My first couple books were exploring the horse-human relationship, and they're both memoirs and about my experiences growing up with PTSD from a trauma I didn't have a conscious memory of, and how my horse helped me find my way to healing.
How do you go from that to a standard bred racehorse?
Okay, so my books have always been about the horse-human relationship, and Greyhound is a horse I was always interested in. He's got a tremendous story. And when I started researching and digging into his story, I realized that much of what was so legendary about him was the way that he connected with the people in his life and in the world at the time. You know, he was a Depression era racehorse. And at that time, there was a lot going on in America. Obviously, the Great Depression, but also impending war for World War II. And people were looking for horses, or for sports heroes, I should say, and other things to connect to. And Greyhound was one of them.
And he was, you know, he was a harness horse and a trotter. So back in those days, you know, harness racing was much more popular than it is now, right?
So at one time, harness racing was bigger than baseball, and it was a sport that really has great American history and a lot of connection to the history of this country. And people, you know, everybody back at one time had a horse, and harness racing
and drove it, right? I mean, it drove a carriage of some sort, or wagon or something.
Drove something, a wagon, yeah. You know, you had your milk and your meat and everything was delivered with horses. That's how you got around town. That's how you transported pretty much anything. And people would naturally race their horses on the streets. And that's kind of where harness racing got its start, was just neighbors racing each other. And it became a hugely, hugely popular sport for many, many years.
So tell us about Greyhound. Why did Greyhound, you know, become as popular as he did during Depression era, actually?
It started with him being... He was kind of an unwanted horse. And back then, especially, a gray standard bred colt was considered very undesirable and fairly rare to get. And he didn't have a lot going for him. He wasn't, didn't have a well-known pedigree. He didn't look like a trotter should. His conformation was unusual, and his way of going was unusual, and his color was unusual. And so that, attracted people to him as he started to perform, and it turned out he was pretty much unbeatable, and that drew people to him more and more. But he also had, you know, his owner was a very generous and kind person, and he had a veteran trainer who was an older gentleman who was very good with him, and he had a groom, a young groom, who was kind of a PR agent for him and was also a very engaging person.
And did he have the same driver throughout his career, or was there different drivers?
He did. He had the same drivers from when he was started. His name was Sepp Palin, and he had been in the sport for about 30 years at that point. And excuse me, he was kind of a guy who had kind of a gruff exterior, but was really a very gentle and kind-hearted person. And it was his technique with Greyhound that I believe made the difference for this horse. You know, Greyhound was a very, a lot of nervous energy type of horse. There's just a little bit of film that exists of him, and you can see that, just kind of playful all the time. And the type of horse that would have been really easy to ruin, you know, with being hard on him or being harsh with the training. And Palin was just a very, very thoughtful, a very intelligent man, and the way that he handled him and brought out the best in him.
And it was a time, I mean, he raced from 34 to 40. And so, I mean, this was truly the Depression and coming out of it time. And, you know, people were looking for anything to distract them. And racing was big back then because it was a distraction, and it was something you could watch, you could see in the papers, you could, you know, you could kind of follow it. And it just took your mind out of, you know, where was the next meal coming from?
Absolutely. Yes. There, as his fame grew, the coverage in the papers was also grew. And of course, they started having radio broadcasts, races, which was great. But the thing that really brought him his initial fame was when he won the Hamiltonian. There was, which is the premier trotting race for 3-year-olds.
Kind of like the Kentucky Derby of harness racing.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. they did a movie reel of him then, which for those who don't know, you know, back in the day, that's the way people consumed their news. If it wasn't in the newspaper, they didn't have television, but they did a movie reel of his win. And they showed that in the theaters. And that was where his celebrity really started for the, you know, a nationwide celebrity.
He set a ton of world records, too, didn't he?
He did, 25 of them in his career. And when he retired in 1940, 18 of them were still intact.
All the way to the 60s, some of them, right? I mean, they were a long time he had those world records.
Yes, his greatest record, the trotting mile in 155 and a quarter, that was actually set in Lexington 87 years ago today. And that stood until 1969, when it was broke by just a fraction, a small fraction, by a horse named Neville Pride. And he has his trotting under saddle record, which was set in 1940, also in Lexington, actually stood till 1996.
Was that at the Red Mile? Were they using the Red Mile back then?
They were. The Red Mile is one of the oldest racetracks in the country.
And one of the coolest, I might add. We lived in Lexington. We loved going to the Red Mile. It was just so much fun. It was great.
It's fabulous. Yeah. It's a great place. A lot of history there.
And the nice thing about the Red Mile today, and still doing the races they do today, is they make it fun. There's always parties and there's like barbecues going on. It's truly a party is what it is. It's a party at the races. And there's very few tracks that have the feeling the Red Mile does to this day.
That's true. They're actually great racing this weekend. So they've got live singing and all kinds of things going on. So
in your research, were you able to find connections or, you know, descendants of the people that were involved?
That was difficult to find because it has been so long. And people who were immediately connected, pretty much everyone had passed away. But because his young groom, Jimmy Wingfield, was only 20 years old when he started working with Greyhound and didn't have children until late. He actually has a son, Neil, who is very much still around and I spoke to while I was writing the book, and he actually wrote the foreword to the book.
Oh, that's cool. So what did your research look like for this particular thing? Because again, there wasn't a lot of footage and things like that. I mean, newspaper articles, a ton of those.
Yeah, I started with three main locations. So St. Charles, Illinois, which is where the horse retired to and where his owner, E.J. Baker, lived. And I went there, and their historical society kind of got me started with some things. I spent a few days there. I traveled to the Harness Racing Museum and Hall of Fame in Goshen, New York, which is an amazing place to go. And a lot of history there, but they have an amazingly huge Greyhound collection. And I spent 8 or 9 days there just pouring through everything that they had. A lot of the pictures that are in the book came from there. And then I made 4 separate visits to the United States Trotting Association archives, where they've got all of the old harness racing publications are there. And I went through them all. They're not digitized, so it was all by hand going through all these old publications, which was actually really fun, but time-consuming.
Yeah, and
so that was a lot of what got me started. And then the newspapers, which a lot of them can be found online, newspapers.com. And I spent hours and hours and hours going through old newspapers.
It's so much easier than going to the newspaper and having to sit through the microfiche, right? I mean, it's like,
I was very grateful that I didn't have to do that.
No. All the days of that microfiche reader, that the big screen thing that you've had to wind through.
Yes.
And anybody under, 50 has no idea what I was just said or talking about.
Exactly, yeah.
What surprised you about doing this book?
excuse me. There was a few things. I don't want to give anything away, but there were a couple that were chronically misreported in Greyhound's story that I was able to uncover. And part of that was just the way that to do the research is you have to go back far enough. And what would happen is something might get reported, say, in 1936 that was not quite right. And the next person to research would only go back to that far. and then it would just be perpetuated forward. So there is a few surprises in the book for me and for the readers. Even those who really know Greyhound's story will be surprised by a few things. So that was really fun. It becomes like a treasure hunt to see what I can uncover and discover about this horse.
I think the timing's good for this too, because I venture there's a lot of people that have no idea who Greyhound was, and partly because it is standardbred racing, right? And it just doesn't have the popularity that flat racing does. But didn't I read the Greyhound also did some flat racing?
No, he never did any running racing, but he did do an under saddle record at a trot.
Okay. They kind of did that promotion stuff back then, didn't they?
Yeah. He did a lot. He did exhibitions and things to draw people to the tracks too. Even in retirement, he traveled all over the country and out to California twice, and had like 20,000 people come to see him, just to see him, watch him walk around or sometimes trot around. They even had his birthday party celebrations at Sportsman's Park, which was near Chicago, is no longer there, but he would travel there and people would celebrate his birthday every year.
Did I read correctly that the Colonel, Colonel Baker, even had his stall air conditioned after retirement?
It's true. He did. As he got older, Greyhound had trouble with the heat, but his stall was magnificent. It was, I believe, 21 feet by 20. And it was just oak paneled, varnished oak paneled, but air conditioned, had a huge picture window that he could look out, and a lounge viewing area for his guests that had, seating and pictures, and his trophies were on display. And there was a big guest book. It was really quite the elaborate display, and he had hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people from all over came to see him, from all 50 states and 27 different countries came to visit him. Wow. At that location. And that stall was saved and has been preserved and recreated at the Harness Racing Museum and Hall of Fame in Goshen, so you can still see it, which is really cool.
I can't wait. This comes out tomorrow, right? It's the 30th.
Yep, the official release is tomorrow.
And where do you recommend people go to buy it?
I would say you can get it directly from the publisher, which is Trafalgar Square. Also, I believe Taborton Equine Books online is offering a good deal on it right now. And otherwise, anywhere books are sold, any bookstore, if you go ask for it or go look for it, they can get it for you. And yeah.
Well, I hope you get the call by the movie company to make a movie out of this, because I think it's one that should be made.
I believe it. Yeah, I'm very hopeful that a movie will be part of this story for Greyhound. He deserves it. His story is it's for everybody. It's not just for harness racing people, and it's not just even for horse people, but anyone who loves an underdog story.
It's kind of Seabiscuit like, right? I mean, it's kind of got that same vibe for it.
His story, because, they're the same era, is very Seabiscuit-like. It's a very similar type of story. And, same type. They were actually contemporaries, so in the same era. And it was it was fun. He was voted Horse of the Year. Greyhound was from a member of the Jockey Club, voted for Greyhound as Horse of the Year the same year that Seabiscuit and War Admiral were up. It was very unusual because thoroughbreds and standardbreds, it was a thoroughbred award, and for a standardbred to receive a vote was had never been done before. So
I didn't know that. That's very cool. Well, I'll put links in the show notes to where you can find the book. By the time you're listening to this, it'll be out. You can go ahead and buy. I can't wait to read it. I know I'm going to get one for Jamie, too. I think she'll find this absolutely fascinating. We love these stories, especially of that era of racing. One other question. Now, match racing was really big back then. That's where they used to race one-on-one, and it was a big publicity event mostly. Did they ever do match racing in harness racing?
They did, but he never did. He never actually did a match race. I think he always at least had two other horses in the race with him. But what they did a lot then was time trials. Mm. So it would be just the horse, the trotter or the competing, and then there would be a prompter. They could run or do whatever it needed to, never ahead of the horse, but always next to or beside. So he had several of his 2-minute track records were
makes sense now, because I read he had 82 heats but only 37 races, and I was going, what does that mean? That's what it means, right? The time trials.
Yeah, but also, yeah, 80. Yep. So he had they were multi-heat races. So he might do 2 or 3 racing miles in one contest. So that would be where that came from. But some of them also were, they would have counted his time trials, which if he doesn't make the time that he was going for, it would be considered a loss.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Interesting how different things were back then, too.
Yeah.
This is great. This is a cool story, and I hope that everybody goes out and get the book. It's Cheryl Erickson and Greyhound, the remarkable story of the legendary racehorse who inspired a nation. I'll put the links in the show notes. Thanks, Cheryl.
Perfect. Thank you, Glenn.
And we'll have you back when they're making a movie, okay?
Wonderful. I love that.
Want to reach a passionate, engaged audience of horse lovers? The Horse Radio Network, with thousands of listeners worldwide, offers unique sponsorship opportunities to connect your brand with horse owners, riders, and enthusiasts. Over 90% of our listeners have bought a product from a HRN ad in the past year. Partner with HRN and take your brand to the next level. Visit www.horseradionetwork.com/advertise today.
Well, as I said, Coach Jen is joining us today because she was available this morning.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad that I'm your first choice.
And she could join on last minute. But we haven't had you on lately to talk about how James is doing. Now, for new listeners, James, how long have you had James?
Got him in December.
So 8 months, maybe 8-9 months. And he was 3 when you got him, right? 3.5. Somewhere in there.
Yes. Yes. He turned 4 in April of this year.
And he's a Kentucky something. Tell us what he is again.
He's a Kentucky Mountain Saddle Horse, which apparently, as near as I can tell, Kentucky Mountain Saddle Horse and Rocky Mountain Saddle Horse, folks, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the same breed, but the Kentucky are supposed to be smaller.
Oh, okay. And he's what? That's 15-2?
He's not 15 hands. He's 14. I think he's 14-2 now that he's grown some.
You don't look too big on him, which is interesting because he's not real big compared to your last horse, which was 16.5.
Well, it's taken some getting used to, but I'm kind of used to the size now. Yeah. Now when I go in and fiddle around with Nigel, who's doing just fine, everybody. Thanks for asking. He seems ginormous. It's like I'm standing next to a brontosaurus.
So in the barn, it's Nigel and then Scooter and then James. So Nigel looks huge compared to Scooter and James. It's ironic that I asked you to do this today after yesterday. So he's a gated horse and, you know, he's a baby. So he's just learning things like Jennifer's never had a gated horse. And so she's learning things too. How's it going?
You know, some days it's going and some days it's going faster.
Yesterday wasn't going so fast. I think I saw you doing a lot of backing up yesterday, unintentional backing.
Unintentional backing up. James is a bit of a spook. He thinks that the universe is a little bit terrifying. And he expresses that suddenly and sometimes violently. No. Most of the time, violently. So I'm getting really good at holding on tight when we jettison ourselves left, right, backwards, forwards, around and around. And yesterday was one of those days that there was a lot of jettisoning.
I know yesterday you were getting more concerned that he wouldn't outgrow this. I mean, Scooter never really. Scooter was this way at the beginning, and then in the middle he got better, and now he's really freaky about stuff again.
Scooter doesn't jettison, though. Scooter gets his head up, puts his tail up, and says, I'm about to leap in the air!
And then occasionally bolts like crazy. So that was
versus,
the problem.
Yeah, versus James, who is very much like, I'm cool, I'm cool, I'm cool. Hit the light speed button. I'm not cool.
Now, I don't know. I thought he would be overcoming some of this by now.
Oh, he has. Think about it. When we got him in December, if you walked into the barn and walked fast past him.
Yeah, that's true.
He would spook. If I walked into his stall and I waved my arm, he would spook.
Does make you
if
wonder.
If he saw a squirrel in the field, he would lose his marbles.
Yeah. I mean,
he had so little life experience. He just didn't get it.
Yeah, his was a lack of life experience, whereas the Hackneys we've had before is because of the way they grew up.
They intentionally make him spooky because James went from living in his family herd, mama and the other mamas in the field, to in Kentucky, and he got put in a trailer with his little brother and brought to Florida, where he lived alone with his little brother.
Yeah.
Without any other horses anywhere around for the past year and a half or so. So he didn't have a lot of life experiences. It was a pretty, he was never really sterile, weaned. But not in a bad way.
He wasn't weaned from the family. So
And there wasn't a lot going on there. So he just didn't get to experience things. And he also didn't have other horses that were older to teach him what to be scared of and what not to be scared of, right? Because they learn from each other. And he didn't have any of that. So he has gotten a lot better. I just have to remember to take it in small steps. And I have to remember that I have to keep his little brain busy. Because if he doesn't have anything that I'm telling him to do, so we're just strolling along. Oh, let's go for a trail ride. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. He's much more likely to go, what's that? Versus, okay, we're walking along here, but we're walking along and you have to bend to the left and now we're going to make a circle. So I have to work harder at it.
Mm-hmm. And then eventually you might be able to do a nice leisurely trail rides at some point.
We have Mo's moments. Sometimes things just kind of come together and he's always more confident when he's with other horses.
Now you're getting a little better at getting him to do his gait, which we still haven't figured out what that's called.
I'm getting better. I have discovered there's one lady on Facebook that I follow. We need to have her on the show sometime because she's fascinating and she does really great videos. And I've shared a couple of the videos. And she recommends that when you're training for gait, it's no different than training a horse to go on the bit and carry themselves balanced. That's a three-gated horse. It's the same process. But she said that if you'd have a smooth, flat place to do that, doesn't need to be a ring. It can be any smooth, flat surface, you're going to have a great deal more success. She said you're really, really going to struggle to get it without that, because gated horses, when you think about it, were designed for going in a straight line on a flat surface that's been prepared. They were made to go up and down the rows of cropped fields. That's where the gated horse came into its own. So that makes sense. So I try to do that. So I'm trying to take a little pointers here and there. So some days we get really great gait. Some days we don't. Yesterday was really struggled with legs going every direction as if he was mixed up spaghetti. And then we got some really awesome gait for a few minutes. So we had good moments with some great gait that I worked through. Cause I have to, when he gets it wrong, I have to figure out how to work through that. You know, when your horse goes above the bit, you have to learn how to rebalance your horse and get him to go back on the bit. Same process. It's just, you have to add the gait to it. So we got that, but yeah, the spooking was definitely, well, he had some extenuating circumstance yesterday.
So
and it had to do with dogs.
Yeah. There were some the neighbor dogs decide.
The neighbor dogs are lovely dogs, but they are the sorts
stealthy
that
stealthy sometimes.
They're stealthy. They'll just be out there doing their thing, and then they will race across their yard at breakneck speed and screech to a halt at the fence and woof.
Scooter would have been gone. We would have been in the next county. So
right. And Nigel would go, "Hi, dog."
Yeah, he didn't care, but
he has absolutely no care about a dog. And we've gotten to the point now. It used to be that would send us across to the opposite side of the property. Now we are. If he sees or detects those dogs coming towards the fence, he'll give them a side eye. But we're pretty much okay. But yesterday, and this is going to set us back weeks. Yesterday, there's a little section of bushes that is perpendicular to our property line. And one of the dogs barked at him a couple times and then left. Well, it went way down about 50 feet away and around to the opposite side of those bushes. So it was behind the bushes where we couldn't see it. And as we were walking past those bushes and the bushes were behind us, he did the attack the fence and bark really loud from inside the bushes. Mm-hmm. She was literally popping out of the bushes. So, we spun around in a lot of circles.
Nigel might have even done that with that one, though.
He might have had a little start. Yeah, so, you know.
And you've worked with a lot of 3 or 4 year olds, but it's been a while. I mean, Nigel was older. You've had him for years.
Yeah.
So,
he was 7 years old when I got him. Yeah. And he had some learning to do, but he had a very different reaction to novel objects. James is very much, I'm out of here. I'm out of here when it's a novel object. Whereas Nigel, when I got him, he would spin and leave. But he only would do that kind of things if he was away from home. When he was at home and it was a novel object, it was always a case of, is that okay?
Yeah.
You're okay with that? Okay, then I am too. But
and then after a while, he just took to stomping them to death. So,
yeah, he just took to stomping them to death. That's right. He would kill them. But he had gone through race training, and you forget how much horses learn when they go through what I call the race training. They're broke to go to the track. He didn't actually race, but he went through the process to get there. And they learn a lot from that. And poor old James didn't have that opportunity. Although he trailers really good. We went to a neighbor's.
Yeah.
Remember last week we drove. There's some folks that live in the neighborhood here who let you pay a couple of bucks and use their really nice arenas. And he loaded up on the trailer like a pro. We drove down, stood at the trailer, ate his hay. He was terrified of the mules next door. But, you know, that's a learning process. I need to find somebody that can just loan me a mule. I'm going to put in the field with him. Or let me borrow their field and I'll put my horse out in their mule field.
Okay, couple quick things. Your saddle, new Western saddle, which is what brand again? This is not a paid endorsement.
It is Circle Y.
But you like it. I mean, it's working out great.
Still lovely. It fits him beautifully. It's very comfortable. I have to admit, the saddle horn comes into contact with the palm of my hand sometimes.
Yesterday, the whole time.
Yesterday, twice. Yeah. Twice, yeah. So still love that. I'm fiddling around with what bit he likes to wear. He's a bit chewer. He lifts it up with his tongue and stuffs it between his molars and goes crunch, 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 crunch. So I'm fiddling around with something that will work better there. And the one I'm using right now, I have better steering. Our lateral control is better because I need to be able to lift up one shoulder when he gets crooked when he gates. But the brakes aren't as good. It's a trade-off.
And, of course, Horse Tip Daily, you're still doing that. So for anybody wondering, Horse Tip Daily's still around. Jennifer's at 1,600 episodes. And you can actually go to horseradionetwork.com and go to the Horse Tip Daily page and search Horse Tip Daily specifically. You can just search Horse Tip Daily. Like if you just did one on hoof abscesses. So if you put in abscesses in the search, it'll bring up all the tips that were about abscesses. So you can search specifically for the topic that you're interested in, and there's probably been a tip about it.
Or three or four.
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing it a very long time.
I just did one with Stephanie, Stud Crud Busters, which I think she was on your show recently.
Yeah, yeah.
I did a tip with her. She's the winky washer, I call her.
Yeah.
She's the winky washer. Yeah. She's lovely. We did a tip about gelding scars.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
If you don't know what gelding scars are, you need to tune into Horse Tip Daily. I will probably post that one this week sometime.
Okay.
So if you haven't subscribed already, go to your player, subscribe to Horse Tip Daily.
There you go. Thank you, Jennifer.
You're welcome.
In 2018 for the Staple Scoop show, I did a series of stories that I called The Rest of the Scoop, kind of like Paul Harvey's The Rest of the Story. And they were written by professional writers, and it was kind of cool because you got to hear the story and really didn't know until the end what the rest of the scoop was. So I'm going to share those with you today because I know most of you have not heard these. Maybe over the next couple of months, I'll share them as well. This one was written by Gail Stewart and was called He Wasn't Done Yet. Today, Gail Stewart, author of 100 Horses in History, writes the story of a comeback after a bit of a tragedy, and it is from a more recent history. As I was working on it, I kind of recalled the event. I had just graduated high school at the time, and Gail Stewart's second edition of 100 Horses in History is out now. She added the last two Triple Crown winners, American Pharoah and Justify. You can find them at Barnes & Noble or Amazon, and make a great gift for any horse lover, certainly. search for 100 Horses in History. We are also super excited to welcome a brand new title sponsor to Stable Scoop, Springtime Supplements. Springtime Supplements has been dedicated to improving the lives of horses with the Springtime brand of supplements, and they've been doing it since 1979. I asked the HRN auditors about using Springtime, and I got comments like this. Yep, I've used their spirulina for my COPD mare and dog joint products. Their customer service was good, shipping always on time. And another one said, I use their daily calm for my mare. And another auditor said, I use their dog supplement, and it seems to work really well. Springtime offers supplements for joint health, immune support, calming, hoof and coat, insect control, and much, much more. Before I tell you about one of their really interesting products, Ahi Flower Oil, I wanted to mention they have a special just for listeners, The Stable Scoop Show. If you receive an automatic 15% off and free shipping just for mentioning the show. Be sure you go to springtimeinc.com/stablescoop, call one of their knowledgeable reps, and be sure to mention the discount code STABLESCOOP. Have you heard of Ahi Flower Oil? We all know about the importance of essential fatty acids for horses. We talked about that a lot on the shows. But recently, a plant was discovered to provide completely balanced omega-3, 6, and 9. They call it ahi flour. Until now, you had a few options. You could use fish oil, but let's face it, horses are herbivores. They don't tend to eat fish. There's also flax, but ahi flour has been shown in clinical studies to provide better omega-3, 6, and 9 absorption and balance in horses. It's proven to be better than flax or fish. This is the type of expertise you get from Springtime, who are always at the forefront of the latest research. And don't forget, Springtime also has a full line of canine supplements to keep your dogs at peak wellness, too. That website again is springtimeinc.com/stablescoop. And now, the rest of the scoop, written by Gail Stewart and titled, He Wasn't Done Yet. On a sunny summer Tuesday morning in London, July 20th, 1982, the Blues and Royals Regiment of the Queen's Household Cavalry left Wellington Barracks in Knightsbridge. It was a typical day in London. City streets teemed with tourists taking in the sights, Londoners rushing about, conducting business. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary as the 15 horses and their riders, parading in formation, were making the short journey to the Horse Guards Parade for the ceremonial changing of the guard, a British tradition since 1660. One of those horses was a 19-year-old 16-hand black gelding, handsome with a wide white blaze and four white stockings. He was born in Ireland, the strong-willed son of a draft mare and a thoroughbred stallion. He had a blue-ribbon winning career as a show jumper, a handy fox hunter, and a point-to-point racehorse. But he wasn't done yet. He joined the Household Cavalry in 1967. Yet nothing in his past could have prepared him for what would happen that morning. Spectators crowded into Hyde Park to see the procession that is part of the pomp and pageantry that is London. Soldiers in blue tunics and red plumed helmets, black horses brilliantly groomed, tacks sparkling in the sunshine. The mounted regiment follows the same route every time from the stables to the parade grounds. Then, at 10:44 a.m., the unbelievable, the unthinkable happened. Someone, somewhere, close enough to see the Queen's horses and far enough away to be out of danger, pressed a button and detonated a bomb. A nail bomb, placed in a blue car parked on South Carriage Drive, where the regiment passed. The bomb was lethal and deadly and scattered shrapnel in all directions. In a few seconds, horses and soldiers lay wounded, dying, and dead alongside Hyde Park. Windows and shops and offices shattered in nearby Knightsbridge. Black smoke billowed from the street, ambulance sirens wailed, police sirens screamed, ports, railroads, and airports were closed. Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Parker Bowles, commander of the Blues and Royals, heard the blast and rushed to the scene, horrified by the carnage. In the mayhem, the injured gelding caught his eye. Shrapnel wounds covered his body, his left eye was badly injured, and his partially severed jugular vein was spewing blood. Parker Bowles ordered a guardsman to remove his shirt and tie a tourniquet around the horse's neck, desperate to stop the bleeding. Looking around, the commander saw what he feared most. Three of his soldiers lie dead, another died in the hospital. Six horses were dead, another was euthanized due to his injuries.
23 people were injured, including 17 bystanders and two policemen. The gelding, the most severely injured of the surviving horses with 34 wounds. He was transported by trailer to the barracks and underwent 8 hours of surgery. 28 shrapnel shards were removed from his body. Even then, he was given only a 50% chance of survival. But he wasn't done yet. He returned to active duty a mere 3 months later and became a household name. He received hundreds of get-well cards and flowers. Monetary donations poured into the household cavalry. Lieutenant Colonel Parker Bowles recalled, "I remembered him for his courage and for his spirit. For me, he epitomizes the finest qualities we see in our armed forces." 3 months later, on October 5th, he received the Horse of the Year Award at the Horse of the Year show in Wembley Arena. He and his rider, Sergeant Michael Peterson, took in an emotional standing ovation. Show announcer Dorian Williams remembered the moment. "I cannot recall any horse stimulating the spontaneous reaction that he did when he suddenly appeared in the spotlight at the entrance to the arena. The audience literally rose to their feet and cheered increasingly in a mighty crescendo." He and Peterson delighted showgoers when they offered a meet and greet by the stands. Brigadier Paul Jepson, honorary veterinary surgeon to Queen Elizabeth, said the cavalry horse boasted bags of character. Other horses who survived the Hyde Park bombing were left traumatized and unable to return to their duties. He was different. His bravery was remarkable. Photos show almost 30 scars on his right side, overgrown with white hair, and are a testament to his injuries and the damage inflicted on his regiment. In 2 years' time, the beloved gelding retired, as a celebrity, from the Household Cavalry Mounted Regiment. But he wasn't done yet, as he had one more parade to do. His last public appearance was in June 1984, in the Queen's Birthday Parade. He left London at the age of 21 for the Horse Trust's Home for the Rest for Horses and 200 acres of green pastures in Buckinghamshire's Chiltern Hills. A life-size bronze statue representing him in a brisk walk and sculpted by Camelia LeMay was unveiled on October 16, 2013 at the Royal Veterinary College in Hertfordshire. "He was a symbol of resilience and recovery," Professor Stuart Reed said. "He really is an inspiration and will live long in the memory of those who knew him." He died at an elderly 30, hailed as a hero and a symbol of triumph over terrorism. Even after death, he wasn't done yet. As a variety of memorials honor him, an equine surgical wing at the Royal Veterinary College, a British Horse Society award given to people who make significant contributions to equine safety, induction into the British Horse Society's Equestrian Hall of Fame, and a banquet room at the Home of Rest for Horses. And his name honors a former officer in the Household Cavalry. His name was Sefton. And now you know the rest of the scoop.
Well, that's it for today's episode. As I said, Jamie should be back here on Wednesday. I think she was flying back home today. And we'll look forward to hearing all about her trip and how Lucas made out at the concert. Hang on, auditors, and we'll have a little bit of a chat right after this for the auditor post-show. Be safe, everyone.